Simon Rich. Comedian John Mulaney has described Simon Rich as the Stephen King of comedy writing. Does this mean that Stephen King is the Simon Rich of horror writing? I should have asked Simon. His latest book is Glory Days. It's Simon's 10th book, and it's as funny as the first 9. Many of the characters are millennials who are worried about growing older. So it's no surprise to learn that Simon recently turned 40 years old. Glory Days is filled with the trademark Richian humor, like writing from the perspective of fictional characters and objects. Like what happens when the world's most famous two-dimensional plumber, Super Mario, has to deal with aging. Or if the ongoing rivalry between David and Goliath happened in today's media climate. Or perhaps simply writing from the point of view of New York City. Simon joins us now to talk about Glory Days, his Broadway debut, and how his recent milestone impacted his writing.
I've always been driven to kind of write from an autobiographical perspective, even if I'm not like literally writing memoir, because I always prefer to kind of through a fictional lens. So like one of the stories in this book is called Mario, and it's about Super Mario turning 40. And it's told from his perspective, and he's just, you know, he's grappling with all kinds of midlife headaches. The biggest thing is that he just desperately needs back surgery. He's riddled with arthritis from running, you know, jumping at full speed, you know, for the entirety of his life, just smashing bricks with his face and his head. And so it's about his like struggle to kind of redefine what it means to be victorious in midlife. And that's sort of the thrust of the book. It's a lot of characters who are pretty limited and in their intelligence and their skill and their sort of self-definition. And they all have to kind of gain perspective and redefine for themselves what it means to win.
Mm-hmm. And the Mario story was one of my favorites. It was great. It was just very funny. And the way you put the Italian accent in there and things, it was just a real pleasure to read that.
Thank you. Yeah. He's been saddled with this absurd way of speaking, which is this incredibly offensive Italian stereotypical patois. But instead of, you know, in the book, he's grappling with some very serious, heavy issues. And so he continues to speak that way, even when he's talking about like existential depression.
Right. And were you worried? Were you concerned at all about putting that patois into using that in a story?
Well, I think that was part of the fun, because like he's such a two-dimensional character in that video game. He's just like a walking stereotype. It's literally two-dimensional. And so I thought it'd be fun to take a character like that and infuse him, hopefully, with some kind of inner life and a sense of melancholy, even.
Mm-hmm, which you did do, and that was the right choice to put that patois in there, because that was a huge part of what made it so funny and entertaining.
Thank you. Yeah, and he's dealing with, you know, like he's estranged from his brother Luigi as another character, and Luigi has finally gotten sober, which is a relief to Mario because Luigi was on death's door. But now Luigi is married to this guy who is really boring and is constantly encouraging Mario to update his resume and pursue plumbing, because it's just like at his age, a more stable profession than princess rescuing. And Mario's resistant to that. And so it's all about this sort of this family drama that's unfolding as well between Mario and Luigi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a really great story. Has writing Glory Days caused you to reexamine the choices that you have made in your own life?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of the stories, like I said, are pretty personal. But I don't know if you would guess it from reading it, because they're so removed from my actual, like, literal day-to-day reality. Like, there's one character who I really identify with, which is there's a story called Goliath, which is the David and Goliath story, but told from Goliath's point of view. And he's used to just absolutely dominating his death matches. He has this one move where he just rips people's spines out of their bodies in a single motion, and it's really hard to defend against. And so he's got an absolutely perfect win-loss record. And now he's fighting David, who's a small child who's never even fought before. And to his great dismay, everyone is rooting for David. David is the world's first underdog. And it's about Goliath, you know, basically being jealous of this younger generation that is coming up out of nowhere to usurp him. I think that's something that I certainly relate to. I think most people in their 40s, I would imagine, are wrestling with the reality that they're not the young upstart anymore. There's an entire generation or even two behind them that is coming for their turn at glory.
Yeah, and that made the story work really well. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the other thing about David that Goliath becomes envious of is that David kind of has more media savvy and knows how to deal with the media more, doesn't he?
Yeah, they basically do the world's first press conference in that story.
Right.
And Goliath is very confused about what's happening. And David just has like an instinctive sense of how to placate and dazzle the media. He talks in perfect sound bites. He says, if you ask me, my mom, she's the real underdog death fighter, because she's a single mother and she raised me and she's the one who deserves the glory. And they're just eating out of the palm of his hand. And Goliath, meanwhile, is just really hungry for more meat because he needs to eat a plate of meat every 15 minutes or he passes out.
Of course, yeah, of course. You have said that your whole book is basically about different types of obsolescence. I find that a very interesting line, I guess, just because I like the word obsolescence. But how so? How is that the case?
That's very much what this book is about. I've always been attracted to characters who are like naive or ignorant in some way, and especially when they lack self-awareness, because it's fun to take a character that is like so close-minded and repressed and see if you could take them on a journey where by the end they have some glimmer of self-awareness. And so I think in this collection, yeah, it's a lot of like really selfish, immature characters who have an inflated sense of their own importance, kind of getting a rude comeuppance, and then hopefully, ultimately, having some kind of redemptive act three.
Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of characters I like to read about, and I'm sure all your fans do, so that's great. You managed to combine the themes of obsolescence and aging in a great story called The City Speaks. Can you tell us about this one?
Sure, yeah, thanks. Yeah, The City Speaks is a story told from the point of view of my hometown, New York City. So it's told from the perspective of New York City. And the city, since it was born about 400 years ago, has just been at war with young people. The young people never stop coming. They show up in groups of twos and threes and cram themselves into my apartments, packing in so tight I can feel the walls begin to buckle. They toss their cigarette butts in my gutters. They leave their empty bottles on my stoops. They dance in my best fountain because they mistakenly believe it's the one from the opening of Friends. On Saturday nights, they swarm my west side to poke my cobblestones with their stilettos. And on Sunday mornings, they stink up my sidewalks with their brunch. He sends, bed bugs into their tiny apartments and rats to their neighborhoods and hits them with pollution and smog and everything he can think of, delays the subway, but it's not enough because a lot of the young people who moved to New York City, they have these creative ambitions, and that's really the reason why they're there. And if they're ambitious enough, they'll stay even if their radiators make a clanking noise or they get bit by a mosquito. And so the city always then has to up the ante and start destroying their dreams. And so the city, he makes them late for auditions. He loses their fiction submissions to the New Yorker in the mail. And if they're doing an open mic night at a comedy club, he shorts out the mic, during their best bit so the scout doesn't hear her. And he eventually makes them leave and has the last laugh. And that's sort of the sad part of the story is, even though he's telling the story, he's kind of the bad guy, this city, this mean city. And then act three of the story, sort of the ending is some people stay anyway, and they start trying to help the younger generation, like by mentoring them and teaching them and giving them advice and letting them crash on their couch, etc. And that's what the city hates the most, because the mentors are even more insufferable because they breed entire new generations of young people who are going to absolutely savage, the city's streets for decades to come.
Very well said. Yeah, this isn't the only time that you have written from the point of view of an inanimate object. Why do you take this approach?
It sounds counterintuitive, but I really love the limitation of it. I really like characters just in general that have like a very limited perspective on reality, because it's just more fun as a writer to then ultimately like imbue them with some three dimensionality. That's why I love writing from the perspective of like Super Mario, because it's like he just shouts out catchphrases in the video game and runs back and forth and he's completely inane. So it's fun to like just give him like a full-on midlife crisis and complex relationships with family. And it's similar with an inanimate object. Like some of the objects I write about, their worlds are so limited that they've only seen a couple of things. And like, I wrote one story called Unprotected, which is from the perspective of a piece of contraception in a teenage boy's wallet. And he's literally only seen like the contents of that wallet. And that's his entire world. The more limited, the more fun it is to ultimately give them some kind of actual emotional payoff.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Thank you.
Thank you for writing it. You helped edit a book called I Am Code, which is about artificial intelligence replacing creativity. Your story, Dystopia, must have been influenced by your AI research.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Yeah, totally. And the way that the AI book came about is through a very weird coincidence, which is that I happen to be childhood friends with one of the scientists who works at OpenAI. So through that relationship, I've been exposed to this AI stuff for a long time, too long, if you ask me. And so I edited that book with some other friends just to kind of show the world what our scientist friend Dan has put onto our computers. And it's scary to see how advanced it's becoming, how rapidly it's developing. And I kind of wanted to write a story in this book that just came at the issue of AI head on. So that's a story, Dystopia, where it's like a mother and her daughter, and they're living in this post-apocalyptic hellscape where the robots have taken over. And it's played very earnestly and very solemnly for the first few pages. They find a book on the ground that somehow the robots haven't yet destroyed, and they're like savoring it because, you know, it's the first time the child's ever seen a book because they've been outlawed by their robot overlords. And as they're reading the book, they realize it's pretty boring and just like a lot of long descriptive passages, and it's just kind of dull. And they start to talk about how boring their old neighborhood in Brooklyn was, where everyone just kind of had the same exact political beliefs and read the same exact magazines and had the same opinions and said the same things at the same boring dinner parties. And they ultimately decide, like, rather than lament the loss of that world, they're actually fine just hanging out in this post-apocalyptic hellscape. It's actually in some ways a little bit freeing compared to their old reality. And that was just sort mm-hmm. of me like trying to write a story that basically makes the point that, like, yeah, there's absolutely a chance that we all end up in some kind of nightmarish AI prison. But a lot of us already live in kind of prisons of our own making, cultural prisons, intellectual prisons, and creative ones as well. So I was like trying to write a story to kind of remind myself, yes, robots might take over, but how big of a shift would that be anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. I'm curious to know if you've read a book called The Artist in the Machine, The World of AI-Powered Creativity by Arthur I. Miller.
No, I haven't.
Okay, because I was just curious because it really kind of touches on what we've been talking about, what you've been saying about artificial intelligence and creativity. So I just wanted to ask you about that.
Cool.
Curious. Yeah. Yeah. I understand that you're going to make your Broadway debut soon. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. It's a show called All In, Comedy About Love. And it stars a number of really hilarious comedians and actors just reading and performing different love stories that I've written. The cast sort of rotates every few weeks, but John Mulaney is the sort of the main actor in the first batch of shows.
And you're just you've written it? Are you performing at all, or just you've written?
No, the audience should be thrilled to know that I will not be one of the performers. It will be all all talented actual actors on the stage. Thank God.
I don't know about that. I'll take your word for it for now. Simon Rich, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on your 10th book, Glory Days. I cannot wait to read your next 10 books.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Simon Rich is the author of Glory Days. Find out more about Simon and Glory Days at wpr.org/beta.
One way she's figured out to make money is to be a guinea pig in this experiment that will alter the 68 points of her face print.
Coming up, Helen Phillips talks about her latest novel, Hum. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.